Greetings, podcast seeker. This is I Think You're Overthinking It, the podcast with me, Chris Hardwick, episode number 1153. I have some live stand-up shows coming up. It'd be real nice if you're near one and you came out. I mean, it'd be nicer if you traveled, but I would never expect anyone to do that. But if it's, you know, convenient, or even if it's like at the edge of convenience, but it's still tolerable, come out to see a show. I'm going to be performing at the Irvine Improv October 22nd, and then November 14 and 15, I will be at the Hartford Funny Bone in Hartford, Connecticut, with my buddy Mike Furman. And also I'll be announcing some more dates for early next year. So go to chrishardwick.com. for some stand-up dates. Yeah, I hope to see you out there. I really do. Thank you so much. The shows are so fun, and the people who come out could not be nicer. It always floors me how nice people are when they come to the show. So I so enjoy getting to say hi. I so enjoy that you come to the shows. And if you haven't been to one yet, come on out. All right, this episode is, this is like a podcast crossover. There's a really fantastic podcast called One Song. It's available on all the podcast platforms. Of course it is. But it is my good friend Diallo Riddle and a really, really great DJ named Luxury, aka Blake Robin. And they basically just literally break down one song every episode, break down the stems of the, you know, just figure out like how it was made, what they did. You know, there's just so much great music and technology talk and sort of understanding the hows and whys. And both of them know so much about music. It's such an enjoyable listen, and I highly recommend it. Even if you don't know every song they're talking about, it is fantastic. And this episode was a blast because we talk about music, we talk about technology. We're all kind of generally in the same zone generationally, so you know, we have a lot of fun talk about like, oh, nostalgia, the 90s and DJing. I was never a DJ in the 90s. Well, actually, I was a DJ in the 90s. I worked at K-Rock. What am I talking about? I was a DJ, but I wasn't like a club DJ. Like, I didn't know how to spin vinyl. I was always jealous of people who could because it is an incredible skill set. And so we just kind of take a walk down memory lane with that. And it was just a blast. I love these guys. Diallo, he's been on the podcast before. He's a co-writer, co-creator, co-star of such phenomenal shows like Southside and Sherman's Showcase. And just a great guy and a good friend. And Blake, it was so nice. We had never met before this podcast, but just such a pleasure to talk to both of them. So this is a really fun listen. This is episode number 1153 with Blake Robin, a.k.a. Luxury, and Diallo Riddle from One Song, the podcast, crossing the streams with I Think You're Overthinking It, as we now roll the thing. Roll the two things in one. So good. I mean, Luxury, we've never met before, but Diallo and I have been friends for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm just a fan of your podcast because I especially not just about the music knowledge and the music theory, which I'm a huge fan of, but also you are just like right in the pocket, like the Venn diagram of y'all's music and sure. Mine is like
yeah,
like right on top. So I really, really,
that's
really,
awesome.
Yeah, I really, really, really appreciate it. And I watch so many like, oh, let's strip down, you know, so many YouTube videos of like, let's strip this down. Let's take out the vocals. Let's take this. Here's what's happening. Here's what this. And I will often bother Diallo, often to bother you about like, what's going on with this one song, like what is, you know, and I think he's actually texted you before on my behalf, so I appreciate
it. Yes, he has.
So I appreciate your kindness and patience. Did you grow up in LA, Luxury?
No, I'm from San Francisco. Yeah, okay. I moved to LA. We moved to LA almost 20 years ago, which is weird because it still feels like the new place I live, but I moved down here to be part of the co-writing industry complex, which is the pop song, you know, matching lyricists with musicians to write for the Biebers and the J-Los, et cetera, of the world. So that's what brought me down here, I guess, whatever, 18-ish years ago, 15 years ago.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, talking about, because I worked at MTV in the 1900s, and talking about the fundamental shift, it's just been very front and center for me right now because of the Oasis tour, which I haven't seen yet, unfortunately. But just talking to people about like that fundamental shift in music. I worked at K-Rock from 95 to 90, almost 98, mm-hmm. at this very pivotal time when K-Rock was really kind of directing, K-Rock LA, not K-Rock New York. I mean, they were both big stations, but K-Rock LA really sort of, that was kind of directing pop music. And then kind of at the end of the 90s and early 2000s, it just took a hard like right, like, and then it just sort of went to like, you know, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, this kind of teen pop, and MTV went in that direction. And it really like the sort of the trajectory of pop music really changed like right at that period. So you moved out, you came down to LA sort of like, it sounds like right in the middle of that kind of shift.
Sure. Yeah. Sort of the, maybe even the beginning of the end, because I was one of the last non-insiders to get a decent publishing deal from what I later came to understand. Like I actually got a decent advance, and the goal was I had to deliver, I had a 3-year contract where I had to deliver 12.0 compositions. So if I did a co-write with one person, that's half a composition. Right. I actually got there. I know people, many people who got deals that weren't so generous with the upfront and that were really onerous in how you end the deal. So there are people that are to this day still in their publishing deals because they, to deliver those 12.0 with the fractional portioning of allocating what percent of the song you did. So anyway, all this to say that, yeah, I was a participant in that. It wasn't successful. Like I didn't write any hits. But I learned a lot about how there is this behind the scene network of people writing songs for pop artists. I think that's more widely known now, but at the time it was, I didn't know until someone called me and said, is this something you'd like to do? I was like, I didn't know that was a thing that was being done.
It's so interesting now, especially because it sort of, you know, do you feel that you developed this skill set during this period of time and now everything's just wildly different? Or does it still, from your end, does it still kind of feel the same? Or is the whole music business just wildly different from 20 years ago?
It's a great question and it's a big question. I'll say my initial response to that is, I think I'm really grateful for the experience to understand at that micro level how songs are collaborated on, because that was a new experience to me, collaborating. And I think that general method still exists for the large part. Like that's how Sabrina Carpenter continues to make her music. Among all the pop stars, Beyonce, everyone is still collaborating with mm-hmm. groups of people, some of whom have had hits, some of whom are lucky enough to get in the room. They have their shot. They miss it. They never get asked back again. That's me. Like there's still me's in the, like, so I think there's still, but I think there are fewer of them and it's much harder to earn a living from it. And that's only getting worse, but the need for it doesn't go away. And then AI comes into the conversation. So there are many places we could take that great question, that great conversation topic. But I think that I was the window of what I was involved in is definitely has now closed as far as like being completely green to it, getting paid to learn and, you know, failing, but getting re-upped for the next couple of years anyway. Like they did renew my contract, even with the zero hits I had in year one. So I think it's fascinating, though. I think to a certain degree, the pop, the machinery behind pop songwriting is still mysterious, like to most people. I think most people assume if someone's singing something, they must have written it. They must have come up with it.
But it is just part of this larger group, this group of people that...
It's like when you watch a movie, you have some sense that Brad Pitt didn't write what he's saying.
Yeah. Like, the lead actor didn't write and direct and produce.
Your brain still has to work on that a little bit because it doesn't intuitively make sense that, well, if you're saying it, you must have thought to say it. Like, so with pop music, it's a similar thing.
Well, and it's also because, you know, film is so visual. So you see... You know, like the pop stars are so front and center and so much mm-hmm. of the focus. I mean, like when you're watching a visual medium, you see everything. You see the lighting, you know, you see the effects, you see other actors, right. You know, and so you might say like, oh, well, this person was number one on the call sheet, but you can see that it was actually a collaborative piece. And then last question on your background before I pull my friend Diallo back into the conversation, where did your encyclopedic knowledge of music and music theory come from?
Well, thank you for saying that. Stage one, being someone listening to music as a baby and then a fan and then a drummer and then a songwriter and then a DJ, like over time, just accumulating different skills in part just because I'm interested, but right. also just, we also grew up in an era where information, meta information about what we were listening to was far more available. You'd buy a record. It was 12 inches by 12 inches vinyl with information on the back, who wrote it, the credits, the liner notes, even the visuals of, again, with the document of the vinyl itself, this analog thing that is tangible, but also the videos. Like, you're getting a lot of information about the artist as you're experiencing it. And that starts to, I started to make connections. Like, oh, I've seen that name before. Oh, wait, John Taylor, Andy Taylor, Roger Taylor, they're all last names. Are they related, these Taylors? No, they're not. How interesting. Birmingham, blah, blah, blah. And you start going down these paths, or at least I did. And then carry that over into the other chapters of my life, being a DJ, being a pop songwriter. It gets accumulative. And last but not least, in the TikTok era of these last 5 years, sitting down when the pandemic hit because I couldn't tour as a DJ anymore.
Right.
And I had all these thoughts about what I wanted to share with people. I wanted to share music with people and these stems that I owned. The process of like turning that into 60 seconds took me down my own rabbit hole of filling in the gaps of what I didn't know so I could properly present it. And that just is now this last half decade and these last few years with Diallo, like that just has coalesced into this fun project where it is reward. I learn and then I teach and then I learn and then I teach. The sort of feedback loop is infinite.
Yeah. If I can jump in there real quick and say that when Luxury and I first started the podcast, you know, like I think it's been a learning experience for us both. It's not a secret to those who listen to the podcast. Luxury didn't really know the songs of the multiple songs of SWV multiple songs by Junior Mafia. And similarly, I didn't really know. I knew who Ozzy Osbourne was, but I couldn't speak on Ozzy and I couldn't really speak on Sonic Youth. I always joked that the Misfits were a very cool shirt, you know, but like I didn't really know the Misfits until Blake and I started talking about them. So I feel like for both of us, I feel like we've come out of over 100 episodes of this podcast completely, you know, what you were saying about like how you would pull open the vinyl and you would look at the sleeve. Like, I feel like we both had our areas where we were really strong and we had a lot of areas of overlap, but we've also learned a lot from each other over the course of these 100 episodes. You know, I think the first time I saw Interpolation was on the cassette sleeve for the Above the Rim soundtrack, you know, and it was just like, it wasn't Interpolation, it said Interpolating, and then it named the song. I was like, what did that mean? You know, and over time, that's just become, you know, Luxury's catchphrase, but I think our audience now knows the difference between a cover and a sample and Interpolation, which, you know, if we accomplish nothing else, it is that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, kind of figuring out, because I think there was the idea of interpolation versus a cover, it's just like, I still don't fully understand it. It's like, oh, but so does it still count as someone else's thing? It seems like it does. And it's like, oh, well, it's already a hit song. So of course it makes sense that it would be a hit song.
unraveling all that, you're not the only one. I am 44 days away from turning in the draft of a book, which is a taxonomy of all these ways music can use earlier music. And that's all it is.
It's so fantastic that you're writing this book.
It's so fun. And like the spectrum of ways, because the origin of my catchphrase, interpolation, is that the first video that I put out with that kind of conceit was coming from me as a musician, knowing that when I write songs, my inspiration process, like if I like something, the first step is like, how do I want to use this thing I like in something new? And the panoply, the number of ways that can be done is, well, I can take some of the recording, I can sample it, a bar, a drum hit, the snare, and or the entirety of it, the rhythm, right? So these are all recording reuse, everything from a fraction to the entire thing, like Jamaica. Or, to your question, I can interpolate it, meaning there's a melody that I like, and I want to take that melody that somebody sung, and maybe I'm going to play it on guitar, or maybe I'll sing it with new lyrics. That's that category. A cover is you take the lyrics and you re-sing it and you potentially re-harmonize it and new instrumentation, but that's a cover. All the way down the line, there's several other categories of how music that inspires you. And just to land the plane on the video story, I made this sort of chart of all of these ways, and I decided to start with the one that I thought maybe people didn't know as well. People kind of know sampling, they kind of know covers, they kind of know remixes. But, you know, interpolation, that's kind of a word you see, as Diallo said, on a Dr. Dre, you know, chronic, you know, liner notes. And you're like, oh, I think I get what that means from the context here. But I wanted to explain it. And then I sort of like was off to the races of like, oh, people, I mean, I made the silly joke. In my mind, I was doing a Monty Python bit a little bit. I was like, and that's called interpolation. And then the background, I went, interpolation, which I think I'm guessing you're a Monty Python fan. I think oh, what's his name? Something Luxury Yacht. Do you know that skit? Something, he's got the nose. I think it's Graham Chapman has the fake nose, and he's pretending in this interview that there isn't a fake nose. He's just sort of playing it off. And his name is Raymond Luxury Yacht. No, Yacht. And he says, no, it's pronounced Yacht. Anyway, I was hoping you, I thought maybe you know this reference, because I don't even know where I got interpolation from. And I sort of thought maybe Chris Hardwick would know.
Is that where luxury came from?
No, that's where interpolation, that's where whispering.
Yes.
Comic aside whispering.
Comic aside whispering from the Graham Chapman sketch.
Let me jump in here because I remember those early videos, and I remember, and I could be, this might be apocryphal, but I remember you saying something like, it's this dirty little secret that's in the music industry called interpolation. I remember you saying that in one of those videos. I thought that was where the whispering came from.
Yeah, I mean, it came from an early video, but why did I whisper it that first time? I don't know. Anyway, that's such an aside. But just to land the plane on that, interpolation was intended to be the first of many things. And then that people kind of liked that particular slice, because there's a lot of videos about sampling already. A lot of videos, hey, you didn't know that the Soft Cell song was a cover by, you know, Gloria Jones originally did Tainted Love. And I was like, oh, this is a lane that people aren't really covering. And here we are. And then many other things happen in this podcast, blah, 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 blah. But that particular slice, yeah.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, I understand the cover process because I've covered songs just for silliness, but just to kind of cross the T's and dot the I's, I'll sort of go through, like, I'll go through TuneCore, which goes through Harry Fox, I think. Then, you know, you have to, there are very strict rules about what a cover is. You can't change any of the lyric. If you change the lyrics, it's technically not a cover.
Then it's an interpolation.
Then it's an interpolation or parody, depending on, you know, if there's some
sort of, how far you want to push fair use.
Commentary. And so I know a lot of people are very confused about it, especially as, you know, artists are, you know, their own labels and self-generating machines. If you're putting on TikTok or Instagram or YouTube, you know, what are you allowed to post? Do you need a mechanical license? You know, if it's a parody, are you okay? What happens if it gets flagged for copyright? You know, it's so there's no shortage of, you know, different ways to interpret and reinterpret music and try to put music out there in the world. But it also seems like there are some gray areas for artists where it's like, oh, Am I allowed to do this? Is this going to get taken down? What happens if it does? You know,
you're nailing what to me is the core problem, is that the gray zone for copyright law is intended to equally protect the old creator and the new creator in theory. But in practice, the new creators are constantly filled with these questions and not clear what's okay and what's not okay. And it's not really clear that what's being protected is what was intended by the laws to begin with. That's just the broadest way of saying what is an extraordinarily, you know, broad and deep topic. Part of the book writing process is me trying to like unpack that and maybe even come up with some kind of suggested conclusion, how do we move forward. But the bottom line is what you just said. If you want to do a thing creatively with music that maybe has some precedent, it's the Wild West about what you're allowed and what you're not allowed to do. On what the takedowns on YouTube seem arbitrary, they seem capricious, they're unfair, and then you waste your time and you're stressed out. Am I going to get a strike? All that stuff is, to me, super unfair to smaller artists, because guess who doesn't have to worry about that? Taylor Swift. Like, it doesn't really equally balance things out.
And are you guys finding that in terms of like, because you'll play clips of songs, but obviously it should fall under fair use because you're commenting on it.
And we only play like 7-6 seconds.
Oh, so you actually do
7-second snippets. Yeah.
Gotcha.
We briefly pause to thank our sponsor for this episode of I Think You're Overthinking It, Squarespace, which of course is the all-in-one website platform to help you succeed online. And to stand out, let's say you want to offer services, all right? Squarespace top to bottom gives you everything you need to offer those services and get paid all in one place. So if you want to offer consultations or create events or experiences that you want to offer, whatever it is, you can create a customizable website designed to attract clients, grow that business, and also get paid on time with professional on-brand invoices and online payments. Streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools as well. So when you're ready, you're going to go to squarespace.com/Hardwick, my last name, H-A-R-D-W-I-C-K, for a free trial. Then use the offer code Hardwick to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. All right. Thank you so much to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of I Think You're Overthinking It, which we now return to.
My brain just jumped back to something you said about 7 minutes ago, which is, are you telling me that John and Andy Taylor are not brothers from...
The Taylor brothers are all from different Taylor families in Birmingham, England. What the hell, right?
God, I mean, this should not be as much of a news break in my head. But just, I guess it's just...
Well, doesn't seem right, does it? It does not seem right. I agree.
Why can't they just be brothers? That's how I sorted it.
I know.
Well, because,
I know.
You know, like, listen, I'm exactly the right age for the MTV. I grew up along with MTV. Obviously, you know, I would hear these great stories about like, oh, when MTV launched, none of the American labels really wanted they didn't really care about it. They thought it was dumb. So then they said, okay, fine, well, we'll just look to the UK. And so that's why we had this sort of like British new wave pop invasion that happened because the British artists were like, we'll do it. And so, you know, I don't know if that's apocryphal or true, but there definitely was an influx, you know, 82, 83 of Britwave. And obviously Duran Duran was just at the peak of that,
yeah.
You know, just
yeah,
like,
we're overdue for a Duran episode at some point. I've been trying to get John Taylor because I know John Taylor a little bit. Like I've met him, and he said one of my songs was in his top 10 songs of 2013. Like I once John Taylor is back in LA, we're gonna pounce on that man and get him on the show to do
a Durani
love fest.
You have to ask him why Andy's not his brother.
Like, why? The question should be, why? Why not?
Why?
I love your reaction. I just got to say, I had the same reaction because for years it bothered me that the Ralph's grocery store didn't have an apostrophe in it. It was founded by two brothers whose last name was Ralph's. So that's just the spelling of their name.
Is that true?
That's true.
Jesus Christ. Look, I would have expected to have my horizons broadened in the music field, but never in retail grocery did I think. And Jello, you've just solved. I have always been sort of bothered by that. Like, it's a possess. It's Ralph. Like, this poor Ralph guy. Did he just not use them? And so they were like, well, we can. He was the owner. He just didn't really support the use of apostrophes and possessions.
It was 1873. We didn't have apostrophes.
We didn't
have
before,
it out yet.
And then it was too pronoun, late.
Before there was pronoun late. Hate, there was apostrophe
the
hate.
Came along, we were just like, screw it. No, I guess his name was George Albert Ralphs.
Oh, my gosh. So, look, go. That's on him this. For having a plural, like, just having, wow. Yeah, that's... It's a last name. Wait, I gotta unpack so that dumb. Part of it.
I really hope that there were just multiple Ralphs who got together and started a grocery store.
Yeah, there was a council of Ralphs.
Not multiple Ralphs. It's just one. It's one guy and his brother, ironically, which is not like the Taylor brothers. It is the Ralphs brothers.
I like the idea that a consortium of like 9 to 12 Ralphs.
Ralph just like
I got together and we're, you know, Ralph. And they just decided to start a
that would have been fun. Unfortunately, that is not the case.
I can't remember what the answer was, so I'm just going to ask the question now, Luxury, which is the question that I had asked Diallo, which is, I watched a whole video unpacking Owner of a Lonely Heart. I think that, you know, yes, that 90215 album is one of the most stunningly produced albums in the history of music, and that was Trevor Horn. What really kind of blows my mind about it is the song Owner of a Lonely Heart. And I listened to that song a lot still.
Yeah.
And watched that it basically seems like a, and again, I'm sorry for trying to get you to do a version of your podcast on my podcast, but that song in my Gen X mind is like, oh my God, they were obviously all incredible musicians, but it's like he sampled their own band.
Right.
So when you see like the little waves of it, and he kind of like he opens the file and you see it all, it's really stunning to me that this guy in like 1982, 1983 just was like, oh, well, let's just take snippets of what you're playing and stack them and build out this sound collage from That's a right. band that really was a traditional, like, I don't want to say traditional because they're a prog rock band.
They're a prog rock band, right.
And so to say, we would say a traditional progressive rock band. They were a prog rock band, so they, you know, obviously were good instrumentalists.
Right.
But somehow it was like, no, you, and obviously they could play the song all the way through, and I'm sure they did a million times live. But just the idea of building samples out of a band's, what they're playing in 1982, 1983, kind of melts my mind a little bit.
Yeah, it's an innovation. Trevor Horn was one of the first, and the Synclavier, and the, I think it was actually a Fairlight, excuse me, the Fairlight CMI, which those are the first two, though, kind of widely available samplers. And they suddenly made available ideas of what you can do. By the way, they're both, the intention for sampling with samplers was just to get new sounds. It was never to take a loop of another record and reuse it. That was sort of a later usage that came out of just like, oh, wait, we can also do this. But Trevor Horn's one of my absolute heroes. We did a Grace Jones episode about a year ago where we gave him his flowers for the first of many times, because we will definitely do an Owner of a Lonely Heart. We will definitely do a Frankie. Maybe we'll do, you know, well, he didn't do Art of Noise, but his crew did. But anyway, we're huge fans of his work. But yeah. What was the question? I didn't hear a question in there. I heard some praise that I can jump on and share with you.
Yeah, the question was just sort of unpacking the history and the, like, trying to figure out, like, where would that come from, you know, because now, obviously, you wouldn't even think twice about doing it. You know, yeah, that's just something we do. But at that time, you know, especially you're working on tape and you're, you know, it's like this sort of digital era is just emerging. And so what, I guess, if you had any insight on how.
I mean, I think you're right to pinpoint Trevor Horn in 1983 as a very pivotal moment in the use of technology in pop music. Because first of all, the technology, second of all, the guy. The previous year, he had been in New York with Malcolm McLaren, and the two of them did Buffalo Gals, which was an introduction to the idea of these, first of all, these two British white dudes in New York City with the DJs. I'm spacing on the name of the DJs. They're credited on the album. Maybe you can put a little superimpose the name. I don't remember, and we just talked about it. But the point is that the idea of sampling and scratching, whether or not they had been exposed to it by, you know, an earlier use that isn't coming to my mind, it's definitely happening now. And this is before Rocket even, which is an upcoming episode of ours. All this to say that you're right to pinpoint that in this moment, Trevor Horn goes back to England, I guess, a year later, and he's like, wow, you can do this with these tools. I just did this for this, you know, crazy former Sex Pistols manager Malcolm McLaren's record, and it was a hit. Buffalo Gals, oh, blah, blah, blah. So you've got sampling, you've got scratching. In his mind, he's like, oh, reuse of recorded material is also an option.
Is he hearing this in New York? Like, where is he?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we've talked about Trevor so many times on the show. He's sort of like, you know, his name comes up and over and over. I mean, I think that in Trevor's case, wasn't there the story of him going to a party in downtown, you know, New York? Is that, haven't we told that story on the show?
I'm not remembering, but you may be remembering something I've forgotten. Sometimes we do the show and I listen back and I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot about that fact.
I think it's safe to say that him and Malcolm and all these guys are hearing the early, you know, sort of like use of breakbeats and DJing and sampling. It's all sort of filtering down from the Bronx. It's coming into these parties in Soho where, you know, coincidentally, Debbie Harry is hearing all this stuff. And it's sort of that cultural, you know, we like the term milieu of New York in the early 80s. And they're applying it to more, you know, like you said, it's not pejorative, applying it to more traditional rock and sort of avant-garde, you know, music made by musicians.
Yeah, especially in the dawn of this digital era, because I remember talking to Thomas Dolby about, you know, like not just She Blinded with Science, but that sort of era of music and his particular era of music. And, you know, if I remember correctly, he was saying he had access to like one of just a couple of synthesizers, like that the physical thing. You know, now we just think of everything as available to everyone. You know, you can go down these rabbit holes if you just go on to, you know, you can just buy plugins, you know, like it, you don't even think twice about it. It's like, oh, well, that's this one very specific keyboard. Here's a suite of other keyboards, you know, but he just had like one of just a couple and was, you know, was had access to it and was able to play with it and create all these sounds and sort of, you know, his sort of mad scientist aesthetic was, to me, very appropriate because he was sort of, it was kind of chemistry with what he was experimenting with and pulling in and trying this and
like
mixing wires and plugging in and unplugging. And so
I think a little bit of maybe what you're talking about that connects those two guys too, is that we're in an era where you can, as one individual, do all the stuff to make the final product, even if you're bringing in the recordings of the band. At the end of the day, Trevor Horn, you know, with ABC, with Dollar, with Yes, with Frankie Goes to Hollywood, all these bands, ultimately, like, they're dismissed at a certain point early in the process, so he and his team can craft what's left and make it sound great, but make choices that are kind of individual, like auteur. It's almost like an auteur, the auteur pop author is suddenly available now. Now, you can go back to Stevie Wonder. We did the Superstition episode. He was kind of doing that, but he also had engineers. He also had mixers. This is now one person, Thomas Dolby, with the technology, can make the entire song down to maybe the final mix. And that's kind of a new thing. We take it for granted now because 40 years later, anyone can do that. But
everybody
in 81, 82, 83, because of these devices and the sounds and the capabilities and sequencing, wow, what a gift for a Virgo. What a gift for a fascist. Like someone with a vision, basically. You can do everything and you can kind of, okay, I got the bass line you played. Now I'm going to like take the one note and pitch it up the sampler because the rest of your performance wasn't that great. It was kind of sloppy. So these are new capabilities that a Thomas Dolby or a Trevor Horn can.
We're literally talking about this on the podcast that we're recording later today because we're talking about how the 2000s were sort of like the last time people were unironically in bands. You know what I mean? Like,
get it? I'm in a band in 2025. Lol.
Like nowadays, like one guy. Nowadays, you know, you could argue that somebody like a Pete Wentz could probably just do everything. You know,
oh, yeah.
He could write it. He could sit at a laptop and figure it all out. My dog is going crazy.
That's not a sample of a dog. You got to sample that. You got to sample that dog.
Yeah, no, I know. That dog wants to be a star for sure. But I'll wrap this up quick because I'll mute. But just this idea that one person can be a band. We've gone all the way back to, well, I always joke about King Biscuit time, which was like this famous picture of a guy who had a guitar and a drum set. It's like 1901. And on his drum, it's like he has written King Biscuit time. It's like an old black guy in New Orleans. And he's sort of like this one-man band. And it's an amazing picture. Just Google King Biscuit time. But we've gone full circle back to King Biscuit time, one guy doing everything.
But also, like, I've watched a lot of videos on, you know, what are some of the things that made that era of music so interesting and what lessons can we extrapolate from that. And one of the most interesting things that I've seen was, you know, yes, you can program everything. You can, you know, all of your instruments can be digital. But it would benefit you, even if you're doing it on your keyboard, play the drums live because in this age of quantizing, like giving something just enough of a human element will just give it a little bit of heart.
Absolutely.
That kind of, and it's somewhat indescribable sometimes. Like, oh, why does something sound so, like, I don't know, there's something about it that just feels a little off. And that, it, you know, like, where you can infuse a little bit of, you know, oh, I played this live, so it's not perfectly lined up.
Your ears can hear the difference. Absolutely hear the difference. I always say that my problem with CGI is that I think somewhere in the back of our head, our eyes can tell us that, you know, that monster is not really there. Right. In weird ways that, like, if you go back and, you know, you look at, what's his name? Roughhausen. What's the guy who did?
Harryhausen?
Harryhausen, yeah. Like, there's still something physical there. And I think that can't be overstated. We talked on our Dilla episode about the fact that he played the drums. You know, granted on a sampler, but, like, he still played them. You know what I mean? And I think that, you know, on a drum machine. And our ears can hear the human that's there. Because it's, even if it's just a little bit off, it's that emotion, it's that feeling that makes it not a perfectly quantized
drum. Is that just because we're older? It's like, is Gen Z, like, is the newer generation, like, do they understand and expect, like things to be like molecularly quantized so that they're all perfectly lined up?
I think it would take more than one generation, honestly. And listen, I love drum machines, and I love a lot of songs that are absolutely got the quantize going. But I think it's a little bit more. It's a little bit more inside than that. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Oh yeah. This by the way is a great little.
Let's all pull out some gear.
Is that this one?
Is that the Volca Beats?
Dueling Beats.
Yeah, these things are great. They're like 99, but this is not an advertisement. They're like $99. It's an analog drum machine. It's pretty simple to use, and it's a really fun. I'll program little quick little beats and use it as a metronome for it to play piano. You know,
it's great. Like, it's this little dinky sound, but it sounds fine.
It sounds cool, and it's a great way. And it actually. Our daughter's 3 and a half now, and I do want to get her, like, a little drum machine when she's a little bit older to just get her, you know, thinking in music, or just, like, a fun toy to play with or whatever. It just seems like a great way to develop
that. Just get her to learn to clap on 2 and 4. Just that's the only lesson that matters.
Yeah, the only strong stance we take is we are so anti 1 and 3.
Have you ever seen the video of Harry Connick Jr. is playing at a concert and the crowd is clapping on 1 and 3 and he slides in an extra beat
to help them out. They're so generous.
Them on 2 and 4. And it's like, he's that level of musicianship where he's playing piano and they're right. 1, 2.
But he's
three.
Not shaming them. It's like, listen, let me help you guys out.
He's helping them. He helps them get on to 2 and 4. And it's really it's really fascinating. It's really interesting to watch. And I also do want to, you know, I do want to give Diallo immense respect for his music knowledge as well, because Diallo and I have had endless conversations about, you know, DJing and how, because I grew up, you know, I moved to LA when I was in high school. I went to UCLA, and in the early 90s, you know, it was all about going to raves, and you'd go to Melrose and there were all these record stores and you'd leave with a crate of vinyl, and you know, I knew people who were DJs, and you'd have to carry those fucking things around.
I definitely have messed up my back from carrying 4 or 5 crates, because crates usually hold like 80 to 100 records per crate. But I like people like Samantha Ronson. I remember, like, you know, she was young. She was younger than me, and she was a girl, but she had like these freaking killer guns, you know, from lifting up those crates. So being a DJ from the crate period was like sort of special. I remember when we stopped using crates. I was DJing the People's Choice Awards 2006, an after party for the People's Choice Awards. It was me, Steve Aoki, and I want to say like Paris Hilton or somebody like that. It was somebody who'd never DJed before. When she showed up and she had like a laptop and a thumb drive, or some version of a thumb drive. It's probably like a hard drive, actually. We were like, what is that? And like, she had like a team hook up all these wires. And I was like, oh, this is the end of an era, because suddenly you don't have to carry heavy crates of vinyl. And more importantly, because it was all on her laptop, she could sort by BPM. So those years and years of knowledge of knowing, oh, this song is about this BPM and this one goes with that, that totally went out the window. Suddenly you could sort all 10,000 songs on your laptop, you know, by BPM. And it was just like, it was the end of a DJing era.
But still, like, do you find that you still do it the way that you've always done it? Or did you adapt?
I totally adapted. Most of my vinyl is either, you know, handsomely displayed on a wall over there, or it's in storage. You know, unless I'm doing an all vinyl night, which is fun for a different reason, because I find I go back to songs that never made the transition to MP3. There's so many songs that didn't ever get, you know, either on MP3 or you never think to, like, download them now. Like, unless I'm doing that, no. I mean, like, I think, like so many people, you know, I was a working DJ, and if you did nightclubs, you had to move to laptops because the sound systems were built in a different way. So all of a sudden, I couldn't play my favorite Tribe Called Quest song because you would hear the feedback from the album on the needle, you know, and so, you know, you can play the Electric Relaxation remix unless you had, like, some weird 12-inch version of it, you know what I mean? Like, you had to start spinning you had to bring your laptop. It was a different time. And it killed off a whole generation. Like, moving from silent film to talkies, like, it really was that level of a whole generation of DJs went away and a whole new generation of DJs came in.
And do you, just for fun, for nostalgia purposes, do you ever just take out the crates, load them into your trunk?
I don't go to the trunk. I have an amazing audiophile level record player at my house. And there I have, like, the speakers perfectly EQ'd for vinyl, and then you get to hear the crackle, you get to hear the hum. You know, I'll always say bass sounds better on vinyl. You know, whatever the bassist is doing, it just sounds warmer on vinyl.
Yeah, I know I've regaled you with tales of, like, oh, and in 1991 we went to an abandoned warehouse that was about, I mean, when I think about, you know, especially those, like, pop-up raves where I, you know, because I was young, I never questioned, like, now it'd be like, oh, is it safe to be here? Like, is this building okay? Yeah. Are we breathing it? You know, it's an empty warehouse. Is there asbestos? Sure. Are we breathing chemical? Like, was this a chemical place? Are we, you know? And then you would just stand up next to a tower speaker that was, you know, like, two stories tall, not really thinking too much about your hearing or, you know, it was, and then watching DJs, you could go to these record shops on Melrose and get cassettes of, like, someone's, like, set, you know, basically.
Bad Boy Bill. Yeah, no, exactly. you come across those DJs. I'll say this. I didn't land in L.A. until about 98. Melrose was still great. It still had all the record stores that you hear people talk about, from Fat Beats to, I think there was one called DMC or something like that.
Beats Nonstop, I think, was another one.
What was it?
Beats Nonstop.
Beats Nonstop, totally. I remember Beats Nonstop. They were all still there. There were still girls, you know, attractive ones passing out flyers like, hey, come to this, you know, rave in Pacoima. And I would go and I would have a great time. And, you know, like, that was a totally different time. It's so weird to me that was a thing that was just accepted, you know. It's just a totally different time.
The pop-up rave. Yeah, I forgot about all those postcards that were, like, by the cash register that had these, you know. And by the way, this was a time when you didn't just have, like, Photoshop readily available, or no. You didn't have Canva, or you didn't have all these apps that could just, like, build a fully designed flyer for you. You had to fucking design the flyer and take it down to a Kinko's and pick out the cardstock and get the, you know, it was a real thing. It was an investment of time and energy. And I wonder if, to some degree, part of why we appreciated it, or why we appreciate things, sometimes things in general, is the amount of energy investment we have to put into manifesting them. That you can't really take it for granted, because it takes so much fucking work to make the thing.
Oh, yeah. It takes so much time to make the thing. I remember the first time I ever spun in L.A., I spun at a place called The Room. It's on Cahuenga to this day. And I remember, like, cutting out – it was almost like a ransomer's note. Like, I remember cutting out, you know, this cool picture from this and this cool picture from that, and taking my collage, if you will, down to Kinko's and printing out 200 copies of it so I could pass it out to people and say, come check me out The Room. I think you're absolutely right. There was so much care that went into that my kids could probably whip up in, like, 30 seconds. And to bring it all the way back to music, you know, I personally want to get an MPC One, and I was going to talk to Luxury about this, because he's always like, you need to buy more gear. You know, that's what it is, buy gear. I'm convinced that, like, nowadays with our laptops, where you can basically, you'll have all the gear just here. You know, it doesn't, I don't know. There's something that I miss about having something tangible there. So I know that I don't necessarily need to buy an NPC one to maybe make these ideas happen. I can probably do it all in Ableton or whatever. But for me, it's just something, it goes back to what you were just saying about drumming it live. Like, I think there's something about tactile, tangible, feeling something, you know, out here, outside of your brain, that makes for that makes the music feel more lived in.
Yeah, I mean, and it is that sort of tactile experience. Where it gets a little on the fence is like, well, you know, I have this very inexpensive Yamaha keyboard, which has weighted keys, so I can play it. I can't really play synthesizer keys, but I can play with the weighted keys. And I just kind of use it as a MIDI, and I have access to literally like any kind of piano, any kind of mic placement, any kind of anything. And I will go on the Rhodes website every once in a while, or I'll go on to Reverb and look at old Rhodes and go like, it'd really be cool to have like an old Rhodes or a Whirly or something. But then I go, but then there's a space issue, and how many times will I really go sit at it? And I guess I'm still playing myself, you know, so if I just kind of run it, it's going to sound the same, you know. Is there an advantage? Because I'm obsessed with old synthesizers, and you know, like I see stuff on Instagram where someone's got like their warehouse full of synths, and it's like, okay, you've collected all those. I would totally do that. You know, are they all going to get played? Would I play them, or am I just, is that just kind of my OCD brain wanting to collect and sort everything myself and just have it? So I go, I have it, you know?
Yeah, like, that is the trade-off. And at the end of the day, the vision of a room filled with synthesizers that were vintage, I mean, that would be a wonderful thing to have, because then you would have access to the original sound. You would have the tactile experience, the tangible experience, like Diallo was saying. And there's something about it being like authentic, for whatever that's worth. All the emulations are close enough, but they're not exactly the same.
Right.
But at the same time, the con list is cost, space, you know, and also there is something, what is the end goal? If the end goal is that you want to create a finished song, yeah, there's a little more complexity that goes into routing everything versus it's all soft synths already in the box as plugins. Instantly, it is in your song without any effort to kind of swap out cables because you're switching from. So that's the trade-off that you're kind of dealing with.
You also
and
have to be a little bit of
something right or wrong. They're both fine.
Yeah, you also have to be a little bit of a mechanic, because my friend has a Rhodes, and when you open up the case, you're like, oh, these get really dusty and dirty.
Oh, yeah, there's maintenance for sure.
But that Rhodes, because it's aged so much, probably doesn't, if you had perfect hearing, probably doesn't sound exactly like any other Rhodes, just because of the, where, you know, if there's like
the intonation,
if there's dirt on the contact points, how the keys have
the been temperament, played. Right, of an actual keyboard is going to be different than pitching, even though a lot of like most modern samplers, you have some degree of like they took a note and they pitched it up and down a few and then they took another note. It's sometimes you'll get the whole keyboard. But the point is, there's kind of like, you know what you were kind of both alluding to it a moment ago, like where is this line with perfection, right? And with visuals, as you were both making the analogy, there is a sense, there's this uncanny valley. Like, that's such a great concept. I think it goes well with music too. You can't really put your finger on where it is, but the interplay between machine and man, sonically, the interplay between machine and man on the screen, George Lucas early stuff versus George Lucas later stuff, right? That interplay of like, man, this kind of crossed the line. I liked it better when it was a guy wearing a monster mask from a leftover 50s movie, right? Versus,
I liked it when he was going to the Henson monster shop.
But again, yeah, right? Is that just our age? Like, because we grew up seeing that, so we
But I'd argue that some of it is innately human, because my son, who's 14, we talk about this all the time because he's a gamer and like he's just a normal memer, like not one of the like crazy, like we're not worried about him memers.
Sure.
But the point is, he knows that language is why I'm bringing it up. And for him, he recognizes, as all we do with our different age from him, that there's something about the eyes that they still haven't gotten right, right? That's like the one last remaining thing with like whatever is the new basketball, is it 2K, right? He just got that. He's so excited about it. The new like digital. So like the eyes are still
in here. Yeah.
They may never get the eyes. Maybe they will. But that's the uncanny valley that even the kids recognize without the backgrounds that I think that we have.
That's fair.
Yeah, and this sort of thematic element does seem to, it's kind of interesting to where the conversation's going, because it does sort of keep kind of weaving back to the tactile experience of DJing, the tactile experience of playing an instrument versus, you know, like where do you pull in the digital, or where do you, like, well, it is a little more, it is a lot more convenient to carry a laptop versus, you know, 120 pounds of like five music crates. You know,
my doctor said my back was going to be ruined. he's like, do you work in manual labor? And I was like, no. And I figured out, oh, I do carry records like this, and I stand in one place, you know, probably putting more weight on one foot than another for 5 hours. And he's like, well, that's it.
That is a little bit manual labor. Yeah.
Diallo, you could just get a flash drive. Like, you don't need to carry around like five crates of,
I remember when my back started feeling normal again, but I will say from like 25 to 35, my back was kind of effed. It's kind of messed up.
You have to lift with the knees. Like if you're constantly, you're probably not thinking, you're lip pulling over and you're doing this.
You're doing that for 5 hours. Yes. There's a lot of bending over and then standing, then bending over. Then you lift something heavy. It's like a bad workout.
But also just the idea that, you know, where you're talking about temperament of an instrument, like a very specific vintage Rhodes, but also I think about Diallo, the temperament of the artist, where it's like, you have all your crates set up, you know how they're organized. No one else would probably know how they were organized, but you know in a minute, you can make a split decision like, oh, I think I want to mix this in. I know exactly where this one sleeve
is. Can I just give a shout out? Diallo Riddle right here is one of my favorite DJs. I've had the privilege of, I've DJed for a decade plus with, I've played with like A-Track. Like I played with like, Diallo is one of my favorite DJs. He's one of the best DJs because what you're describing is, it perhaps has become innate because of experience. Maybe nature, maybe nurture, who knows? All I know is the result is he knows what to play, how much of it to play, when to get in, when to get out, when to switch up the tempo. And the genre blending, it's not like there was this moment, I guess, like open format DJing in the early 2000s, right? Like I remember going to like some of those and like the transitions were too quick. Like, and I remember a good friend of mine, he'd be like 30 seconds of this and then 20 seconds of that. So he gets that all right. He gives you just the right amount of it. So all this to say, I'm giving props to my friend Diallo as a DJ, that. Like you're describing it.
Listen, I was DJing one time with James Murphy of LCD Sound System, and we were agreed that there became, when laptops came in, this sort of like ADHD level of like, the DJ were killing the songs way too soon. Like it was like, yes, 30 seconds. 30
because you can do it, so you're going to do it. Yeah. Like, oh, I can do that. Well, I can quickly, unlike like, a record that you had to make that effort with.
We're like, in the vinyl age, like, if a good chic record might be 8 minutes. You can go to the bathroom, get a drink, come back. Right. Like, you know, songs would play longer. I will say real quick, though, that I still have nightmares that the song is running out. And then I have, like, less time than I need to get the next song on. That's still a nightmare I have. It's clearly a trauma that's followed me. And I think it maybe happened twice in my entire DJing career that I realized, oh, shit, I don't have enough time to get on this next song. So sometimes you might get on the mic and be like, y'all having a good time or what? You know, like you do whatever you needed to do to try and buy yourself a few extra seconds. But yeah, I still have that nightmare that like the song ran out.
Does anyone have a crate of records in their trunk? I'm looking for like 135 to 138 BPM, like something that will mix in.
Oh, well. I'm sorry. Real quick, I'll say this too. The one really bad thing about the crate days was that if somebody requested, hey, I want my party to be 70s soul music and just that, you would show up with all your 70s soul music, and then you get there, I'm like, can you play DMX? And you're just done. You're like, no, I can't. I have these 200 records. That's what I brought. And I got hated on sometimes because, like, people would request one thing, and eventually somebody wanted to hear Britney or DMX or something really popular. So cool people would say, I don't want that music at my party. You show up. Nowadays, that's not a problem. Like if the party goes this way, you have every song on your laptop. But back when you had to make a choice about which 200 songs or artists you were going to bring, you didn't have that as an option.
That's really interesting because it's sort of, and I'm sure this is, we could probably talk for days about this to the excitement of no one but me, but the idea that that a lot of artistry comes out of limitation, you know, like that you're physically limited by what you have, so you make it work with what you have, or you have to figure out ways, or even like riffing in between songs. That could be something that like someone will go, oh, I really like the way this guy riffs in between songs, but to you that's just a workaround because you're stuck and you need to, you know. And so it do you think that having limitations sort of engineers a little, like forces you to be a little more creative, Or do you feel like, well, no, yes, but also if you have unlimited access to things, you can also be incredibly creative. I find that I freeze up when it's unlimited, because it's like you could go to the Google search bar and go, wow, I could learn about anything in the history of recorded history, and I have no idea what to look. I mean, I have the access to near infinite knowledge to what humans know, but I don't, it's not like I don't most days go do that. So
the answer is absolutely yes. Yes. Limitations, constraints are fuel creativity. Yes. Absolutely. So the trade-off is that you will take longer to do things because you have too many options. That is the modern condition, probably in every field. But of course, you also have access to everything. How wonderful. So therein lies the yin yang of all of any individual creative effort, is like finding the balance. Like, that's why deadlines are good. That's why having collaborators are good. In my personal experience, having somebody else as you're scrolling through 8 hours of kick drum selection scrolling, somebody saying, that's the one, let's move on. That can be quite useful. So there are ways you leverage.
That's usually me. I'm usually like, that's the one. Yeah. Let's move on.
That's the one. These are being aware of how being without limits can be detrimental to the process, and recognizing when to bring in somebody else, when to like ask for a fake deadline. Like, can you just tell me it's due tomorrow? Like, that kind of stuff is useful, I've found.
Can I just say, this conversation has helped me figure out why, when I was a kid, I always was so excited to get to Blockbuster Video, and then I'd get inside Blockbuster and I could not decide on anything to watch. Like, it was just like, too many options.
Yeah.
There was a personal algorithm in your head in the Blockbuster store of, first of all, what's available. And God forbid a fucking box should be on the floor that they don't have the tape after you spent 45 minutes trying to find. You know, God damn it, I got to start this over. But that algorithm of like, who's on the box? What's the cover art? What, you know, what genre is it? Do I recognize? Because there was so much pressure, because once you got that thing home, that was the thing you had to watch. That was it. You were paying, you know, $4 for it or whatever it was, and you couldn't go back to Blockbuster, you know. So how do you decide?
We briefly pause again to thank our sponsor for this episode of I Think You're Overthinking It, BetterHelp. BetterHelp is all about matching people with therapists, all right? Maybe they've helped you. Maybe they've helped someone that you love. Maybe you're thinking about getting therapy and you're not sure just yet. And maybe this is the message that might finally make you say, you know what, maybe it's time, because they have helped over 5 million people worldwide match with therapists on their mental health journeys. That is millions of stories. That is millions of hours of help. And what better time to do that, because October 10th is World Mental Health Day. And this year, BetterHelp is shining the spotlight on therapists, people who truly make the world a better place. And if you're comfortable, maybe share a moment in therapy that made an impact on you. You don't have to do it publicly. Maybe you just do it in your heart. That's okay. You stop and take a little gratitude moment, or maybe you make a point to tell your therapist, hey, I just want to thank you for, you know, all the times you've been there for me and really helped me through stuff, all right? Because the right therapist can change everything, and BetterHelp has quality therapists. They're fully licensed in the U.S., and BetterHelp will do the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 5 million people globally, like I said, and it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for live sessions based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So this World Mental Health Day, October 10th, they are celebrating the therapists who've helped millions of people take a step forward. If you're ready to find the right therapist, BetterHelp can help you start that journey. And listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/Hardwick. That's my last name, H-A-R-D-W-I-C-K. And that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Hardwick. Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring I Think You're Overthinking It, which we now return to.
You know, but by the way, I wish you guys could look at my Google search, because literally over last weekend, I Googled vintage Rhodes for sale, because I was convinced. I was like, I need to have a vintage Rhodes. I need.
Well, they have
that's
a new.
That's the sound of everything we like is the Rhodes. Yep.
They make a new one. I'm kind of keen on the new one. I think it's the MK8, but you can customize it. You know, so you can get a different cover and different legs and a different kind of backdrop. And, you know, it's, I mean, it's not inexpensive, but at the end of it, you would have a brand new Rhodes. Yeah. that, you know, again, I think if you're a tinkerer and you love to get under the hood and play with stuff, a good vintage keyboard is great because you can customize it or you can see how it works. There's a YouTuber that I want to give a shout out to. I don't know him at all, but he has an interesting channel and his name is David Hillowitz. And basically what he does is he's a musician and a programmer. And he also is really good with his hands. Like he's very handy. So he'll go find he found like a magical musical thing, which was this toy that when I was growing up looked like, it was like a keyboard guitar kind of a thing. It was just a long, it kind of looked like a digital sitar actually. But anyway, it had buttons on it and you would like, it was just it was a digital keyboard basically, sort of shaped like a guitar. And, you know, so he'll find stuff like this and take it apart and fix it and rebuild it. And then he will make a song with it. And because he's a programmer, he has made a sampling platform, and then he'll create a sample of it just to record it.
Right.
And he has free samples that you can take, and if you subscribe to his Patreon, I think, maybe or whatever, then you get like the full library of his stuff. But it's almost kind of a public service of like, oh, you're sort of cataloging. Right. And it's also like IRL instruments. He'll find like a really old, some old banjo, and he'll fix it and restring it and then create a sample of it. And it's just like that process, if you're a tinkerer, is really lovely right now.
There's the separation of, if you want to think about it, any instrument is going to be what the sound is, what the form factor is, how is it that you make the sound. And then there's a sort of X factor of almost like that uncanny valley give or take thing. It's like there's this area where it is the human grain. There's something authentic which you can't put your finger on. But I would argue, almost counter argue, because that isn't my way. I respect it. I appreciate it. There's a degree to which it can kind of be performative. You kind of really don't need the real Rhodes. It's cool to have. Like, it's kind of aesthetically awesome in your studio, right? It's sort of like when they do interviews with musicians in modern day documentaries, and they're always in a frickin' recording studio with 48 tracks and like the giant expensive speakers. But most music is not made in those environments anymore. Yeah. It's performative. It's sort of, but it's also like kind of a signifier to the world. Like this musician is credible because of this 48, this desk that they've never touched.
Right.
So there's a degree to which making Rhodes sounds with an actual Rhodes won't really make it any different for the product than if you used an in-the-box Rhodes. But if you're a performer and if you've been playing the Rhodes for years, I can understand why. Yeah, that makes sense that I want to continue that. But if you've never used a Rhodes, just buy a Rhodes emulation. That's kind of all you need.
that'll work too. I mean, I love vintage guitars. I mean, I love like vintage acoustic guitars. Mm-hmm. I don't really have. I bought a vintage electric guitar and I took it back just because it's like, oh, that one has like wire, like there's electronic, there's stuff in
there.
What
did you buy? Like a Flying V, something cool, like super.
It was an old Mustang. It was an old Mustang from like the 70s or something, and it just kept going. Or like I have,
I bought a Flying V once. You know, like Randy Rhoads.
Oh yeah, yeah, I know the
super metal. And then I realized, wait a second, I can't put it anywhere. Like it's really awkward. Like there's no place to rest it. You have to be standing up and wailing on stage for like a Flying V to
make
sense.
That's where put it on stage. You have to leap off the drum platform and do a sidekick. But I wanted to do the guy who fixes my guitars is really great. LA Guitar Repair in Sherman Oaks, it's a great place on Ventura Boulevard. I'll just give it a shout out. But he was like, oh, have you ever heard of the Marine Rider? And the Marine Rider is a guitar that was made in the 90s. And it's kind of a mini style electric guitar, but it has a speaker on it. And it's got two little modes, so you can get it a little fuzzy or whatever. But I love that one, but I did have to take it in to him and have the electronics repaired. And it was kind of an interesting story with that guitar because we assume that everything is available online about everything, to my point earlier, and I could barely find any information about this one little guitar that I would have thought, oh, of course, it's a little 90s guitar that you can travel with. of course there'll be tons of, and there's almost no information about it at all. And it's called the Marine Rider. Are you familiar with it?
Never heard of it. No. And maybe that fulfills what you were saying earlier. Like maybe that's a constraint that's useful to you. The fact that it is so challenging to get to function properly and, you know, there's not a lot of choices you have. Maybe actually that's great for your creativity with that machine, because you're going to be limited in what you can do with it.
I'll tell you why the limitations kind of pushed me in that direction, but I wasn't able to make it work, which is with touring with stand-up, I bring a guitar and I have to rent a keyboard in every city that I'm in. And it's kind of a pain. And I loved the idea of a miniature guitar that had a built-in speaker that I wouldn't necessarily have to run through a DI or mic separately. It's like, oh, this might be kind of fun and kitschy if I can just pull out this guitar and it's just ready to go and I can play it. But
it also sounds like it's kind of funny looking, so it's an instant gag visual.
Yeah. It's like those parlor size guitars are sort of the uncanny valley of guitars, because it's like, oh, it's not tiny, but it's just small enough that it looks a little weird, you know? But I don't have big hands, so that's very helpful for me.
Wait, what is it called again, Chris?
Marine Rider. It's called a Marine Rider. What I pieced together was like, oh, there was a guy who worked at another guitar company and he made those, but then I think the company went bankrupt and then it was bought by a Japanese company and then they were manufacturing them overseas and then sending them. So it was like, there was a little bit of lore around it, but it was that thing of like, what the fuck, internet? You're supposed to have everything about everything, you know? And I couldn't really find out much about it. What do you prefer to play, Blake? What do you like to play? What instruments is your favorite?
When I play live, I mean, the last gig I played, which was too long ago, I was just thinking 2026, we're bringing live back. The show's going to go live. Y'all and I are going to DJ live. And I'll probably go back to, like, it's fun to play bass live. That's just the most fun. That's been my preferred go-to. But that said, and this actually goes back to Diallo, like I keep sending Diallo videos. Do you know this group out of Chicago called Octave One?
No.
There's just a lot of my favorite area for music right for the last few years, because it's the area I operate in, is where bandness meets DJness. So there's this like zone of electronic but live. And, you know, Disclosure, Diallo just sent me the video of their next tour. Like they're one brother's on the drums, one brother's on bass. But of course, there's also a backing track and there's also going to be some live manipulation. And we did a Chemical Brothers episode. All this stuff has in common that I love it when all this stuff is interplaying, which, by the way, goes back to the man versus machine conversation of earlier. All this to say that in my vision that I've sent these videos to poor Diallo and he's like, okay, I get it. There are two dudes that are manipulating lots of devices in real time, so it's kind of electronic music. Again, it's like the Chemical Brothers. You have some sampling, you have some live, you have like a mixing desk, so you're making volume decisions and bringing devices in and out. That to me is the innovation. That's still the coolest zone to be in. And as soon as I said that, I was like, yeah, but just bass drums and guitar is also cool. Like, I kind of miss jumping on stage with a band and drums behind me too. So I don't know. Music, there's so many great ways to make music, and I like all of them. I'm an equal musical, like, anti-gatekeeper.
Well, I apologize to the audience if they hear this twice, because it is something that is, that I do think about a lot. But, because to learn music, I started writing and making songs. And I think one of the quicker ways, or at least for me, or the way my brain works to learn music, is to write songs, to create songs, because the things that you have in your head, even if you don't know music theory, even if you don't really, you know, understand, it's like, it forces you to start to understand how and why things work and how they're made, more so necessarily than just playing someone else's music. If you have an idea in your head for something you want, you have to figure out how to create that sound. And I know that there are ways now where you can, oh, I'll just go on, you know, Splice or whatever. But also, like, I work with a really great producer, and he has really helped kind of manifest these things. And I had never really intended to release them, because they were just sort of like comedy songs. Like, oh, I have a bit that's like a half-baked bit, I'll just turn it into a song. But now that I have enough of them, I've like, well, I guess I should put them out. And this is not just a story about me and the stuff that I'm making. This is a larger conversation about how. I know that I can release things myself. I have a TuneCore account. Of course, I can do that. I know what the process is. But something that I talked to Rick Beato about at length when I was doing a podcast with him, which may or may not be up by the time this goes up, is the idea that my Gen X brain thinks like when you put something out there in the world once, you kind of can't repeat that thing over and over again. But I've watched so many videos about like the way music is now and the way that people are sort of battling with algorithms is you just clip out a hook and you post, you know, 30 videos of that same hook, but with different visual interpretations, because the algorithm's going to scrap a lot of those, but one of them might catch. And right. when it does, then it kind of elevates the whole pile. So I guess, you know, what's your...
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to jump into the question. Like, I was anticipating one of the... On that topic, I think you're right that there is a line age-wise where, yes, there's preciousness, there's kind of scarcity, there's kind of once and then don't repeat it, which is no longer the case for anyone under whatever this 8-30, call it, just like randomly picking that demarcation line. So I think that I personally have had to learn, and I have friends in my peer group who are still challenged by changing how music gets released. It's an album, you put out a song, you put a lot of money into a video, and then 6 months later, it's like it's got to be frequency first and duration of what the content is can be shorter, but also multi-platform, multi-varied, multi-different people are contributing, as you said. It's not your music video necessarily. It's music that lots of people's videos are, lots of people are putting in their videos. That's how you think of music videos now. That's how you should think of music videos. You're making some music and figuring out how other people can be the distribution engine, like the Coke machines distributed across the country, as opposed to, if you want to watch my video,
I haven't even thought about that.
You've got to come to my IMAX theater. No. We want them all over the place, right? So there's distributing the content, there's surfacing it from the middle, right? That's another thing we talk about a lot on our show, because we take clips from our show too. And our dialogue with our social media team is like, I know that this entire bit is interesting, but if the first 3 seconds aren't like, what the fuck? No one's going to watch second four and onward, right?
Yeah, and then so the algorithm's going to go, oh, this isn't interesting. I'm not going to feed it to anybody else.
These are new. We just have to, at our age, in our cohort, it is a retraining of the brain. You're totally right. It isn't like the previous era where, forget about it. Zeppelin, remember how scarce they, like getting any interview or picture, there was an era when musicians and artists were hard to come by, and that was part of their value. Now it's the opposite. You want frequency every day. There's something that the person whose music you like is saying something to you is expected, and maybe not the worst thing in the world. I actually have gone through my own, you know, sort of, I hate this, into my own, this is pretty cool. If you lean into it, it's an opportunity to communicate with people that you're trying to communicate with. At the end of the day, the music is kind of a communication device for an artist. Like, I'm trying to connect with you. So I have more touch points to connect now.
Yeah. Diallo, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I feel it so much because obviously I do the podcast with Blake, and I think that we try to post something every day. But even as an actor, like, I get recognized more for this podcast now than I do for Southside or Sherman Showcase or the TV shows that I've done, because I think it's sort of true in all media. You sort of have to constantly remind people that you exist, unless you've already sort of made it to the highest tier. You know, like, obviously somebody like a Kendrick Lamar can come out with an album every 4 years. You know what I mean? But I think for the rest of us, to a certain extent, yeah, you kind of have to sort of be out there and doing stuff, which is fine, because one thing I love to do, clearly, is talk about music with, you know, pretty much anybody, but Blake specifically, because I do feel like, you know, if I have a knowledge base and he has a knowledge base, I need more hands for his knowledge base. But if we have these knowledge bases, we sort of fill in all the gaps. And so we can do Fall Out Boy one day and Olivia Rodrigo, but then do The Clash, you know, with someone like Fred Armisen, or do, you know, Jimmy Jam. Literally this morning we were texting with Jimmy Jam, and I was saying it was becoming a podcast on text message, because as he talked about the songs he's worked on, we just kept being like, oh my God, I love that song. Oh my God, I love that artist. So why not surround yourself? If you have to do something every day, why not talk about music? I will say that I met Blake, you know, I met him before the pandemic, but we became friends during the pandemic. And ever since we became friends, we've talked about working together. This podcast is just one of many things we've talked about doing together. We worked on some music for Sherman Showcase, which you were on. Yep. I loved the Talking Sherman episode of Sherman Showcase. you know, we want to make more music. You know, me and Blake did a song called Black Nerd that I'm very proud of. That, you know, he taught me how to play a little bit of the guitar on it, too. So Black Nerd is the only song that we've really put out together. But when you held up that little drum instrument earlier, I don't know if you remember this, Blake, you actually loaned me one of those for like a couple of months, and I had a lot of fun working on it. And we did a song called that I saved as Rooftop. I don't know why I saved it as that. It made me think, oh, we need to go back to Rooftop and finish working on that. You know, I think, you know, it's a very weird industry. It's a very weird time. There's like a guy on Instagram, I forget what his name is, but he like you guys, says, hey, put six things out every day, you know? Not six things, but like put out
too much.
Put out your song six times, and like you said, well, maybe one of them will hit or something like that. But it's very weird. We're all learning.
Just the change from scarcity. It's and it's so wonderful to see this recurring idea through every facet of the conversation that we've had. Scarcity of how many albums you could fit in your car. Scarcity of like, oh, this one guy has this music and he stylistically does this very specific thing. I won't have access to it any other way unless I see it in this moment. Or scarcity of an album or a short film promotionally set to a catchy song, which we later deemed were music videos.
Chris, I love that you're making this through line, because you're making me think, like, you're right. I think the through line in our cohort too, and the big change, if not one of many, I mean, I can't simplify it to one expression, but this is a big part of the difference between then and now, is then was scarcity, now is abundance. Now our children all have everything in their pocket. Any type of media, information, entertainment, all, you know, that cliche is freaking significant, because in our day there was a scarcity about it. You didn't have everything. You bought a record maybe only having heard one song, if that, like,
and it was
so
a huge
many,
commitment.
It was a huge commitment,
and that was part of the value of it. And there is this sort of theory in with comedy of, like, you know, if tickets are free, people sometimes are less invested in the show because they didn't pay anything for, I mean, that's it's a complicated financial model in the sense, of course, they're paying for drinks and food or whatever. They did leave their homes. But the idea of, like, when everything is accessible, like, where do you place the value? Like, where do you place the value? Even the idea of, like, you know, just this sort of, hey, don't worry about releasing an album. Just release singles and then just try to meme them out as much as you can over 4 to 6 weeks and then start the process over. You know, there's no, like, I'm releasing an album on this day. Obviously, if you're Taylor Swift or Beyonce, or that's very significant. But to most other people, it's really just like, it's all so in the moment. And, you know, with comedy, like, do comedy specials mean anything anymore when we have podcasts, or we're just clipping out crowd work from shows, or it's like, you know, people, algorithms have sort of really conditioned people to create their own package, you know, based on their choices and whatever the algorithm feeds them, versus like when the artist would kind of decide, well, this is what this is, and you can only get it in this package.
And I think leaning into the abundance that is the fact of now, like, we can fight against it. And by the way, everything's also a balance. Everything is yin and yang, right? So for all that I'm saying about abundance, which I think is maybe neutral, I was going to say great, but I think it's mostly good. Maybe it's just plain neutral. It just is what it is. We just should get used to it.
It's different.
And as artists, when we release things, put that into our brains. Like, I know it's not like it was before, but, like, get over it and do the thing that you need to do to be successful. The flip side of that is there's still room. And in my life, the version of it is that I just started getting back into vinyl collecting in the pandemic, which I had put on hold for 20 years. Like, I bought records when I was a kid, and then, you know, CDs happened, and then MP3s happened, and the abundance was great as a DJ and as a remixer and as someone who's sampling. It's so much easier when it's already digital. But in the pandemic, I went back to sitting on the greatest joy to this day. Like, what I'm looking forward to doing tonight when I get home after a long day of doing, we're doing this, another podcast after this, like, I'm going to put on some, I just bought some new records. I got it, but I'm obsessed with Jamaican, like, dub and vinyl and rocksteady, and rocksteady on vinyl. And to me, going to put it on, going to listen for 18 minutes. Then I'm going to walk over. I'm going to flip it over. I'm going to read the liner notes. I'm going to read about Cox and Dodd for the 500th time. I already know about Cox and Dodd, but the liner notes in this Studio One Soul Jazz series, they're so great. And they're a joy to read while you're listening. That to me is the counter there's some scarcity in my day from that. There's some effort required. There's some tangibleness in my day. After a day of abundance and content creation and lots of clips are going to come from this, and I'll have 2 weeks worth of social media content. Yay. Like it's that'll balance out the day a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about experiential, like something that's experiential. And I feel like experiential used to be the default because everything required a bit of work to attain or even play, you know. And so that idea of creating this experience, but I do believe it can coexist. I don't want to be old man about it and be like, it was better in the old, you know, you know. But because I am excited. I am excited about the idea that's like, oh, well, if I have songs, I can literally make them in a day, and in Tuesday they could just be out in the world, and that's really exciting. It's just navigating, well, then what? You know, how do you, and again, that's just a different rule set. I can't say that one is better or worse. In the old days, like,
I don't think you have to. I mean, that's we're living in Western society, but there are non-binary systems out there, to like, meaning not black and white, right? That's why I said the yin and yang thing, because I keep coming back to that whenever I'm like, it's just about holding two things in your head. Like, that's such like a kind of online phrase of the moment, but like, it's true. It's usually the answer is you don't have to choose. There's only one answer, and it's this. Part of the problem that we're facing in so many areas is people that are needing black or white answers, but most of the time, or so often, a little bit of yin and your yang.
But also, it wasn't all great 30 years ago. 30
it
years
wasn't,
ago,
no.
If you were a band, you had to be chosen by a person. There are only a handful of people even control these gate.
I would have not have survived. Outlets.
And, you know, you talk about, like, you know, getting the publishing deal that never goes away. You could be indebted to a label for the rest of your life because they advanced you too much, or it didn't perform, or they, you know, like, or there were charges that you did. You know, I had a friend who was in the band in the 90s, and he was like, yeah, one year the band, the label sent us these CD clock radios for Christmas. And we're like, oh, what a nice present. And on their next statement, they had been charged for it. It's like, we didn't even ask for this, you know? Right. So it's like that idea of, I mean, listen, it is an incredible time. Now it's, you're not trying to get the attention of a couple of different people. It's just like, how do I cut through everything? How do I, you know, I always refer to the algorithms as like, you're sword fighting with invisible robots. You don't, you're trying to figure out, like, you even said it intuitively, Blake, like the first 3 seconds has to be good, or it's just, or the doesn't matter what's in the rest of the clip after that.
And it was an episode, I try and start off by saying, Blake, you're totally wrong about this.
Stupid idiot, I hate you. And then we just use that as clickbait.
And then you backtrack.
Right. We did start a segment called Fight Me, and a lot of our clips begin, hey, fight me, and then it's just like a chill conversation.
that's fantastic. But that, because the delivery system is a certain way, that is a limitation that is affecting how you express the art of it, which again is like, in 50 years they'll be able to look back and really parse all this out and understand it. But it is interesting now that, like, oh, well, these are the limitation choices we made. So there certainly are limitations that we do that are forcing us to be creative, but we do just have to find them and not be so rigid in our old person ways. Like, I want to speak positively about stuff that's going on. What are you excited about now, Diallo? Like, what musically, what are you excited about?
Oh, to truly draw a line between what we were just talking about and new artists, Pink Panthers. I really like Pink Panthers. Her last album came out, I want to say the whole album was under 30 minutes. All of her songs are very short, but I really like her music. I like her vibe. I found out she's like a serious chess champion lady. And most of the music that she's sampling is stuff from my favorite dance music period. It's like Basement Jacks and Underworld. And she's sampling all the stuff that was like late 90s to mid 2000s dance music before it became sort of more Daft Punk Justice driven. And I'm really here for it. Her latest album, even her previous album, was really cool. She sampled an old drum and bass track that I love. Adam F's Circles, great song. She found a way to sample it and make it into a pop song. So for me, audibly, Pink Panthers is something I'm very excited about right now.
And Blake, what about you? And it doesn't have to be a band. It can just be like a thing.
I mean, I think I'll just double down on what I was saying earlier. Like, as there are new things, like the new thing, the newish things, I would have maybe said Pink Panthers, because we're both big fans. both of the music, but also like the borrowing and the referencing. Because that's, I love that. That's like music as a lineage and a conversation with the past. I love the discovery that comes from somebody interpolating, sampling, whatever it is. And she's got that in almost every song on this new record. I think Turnstile are great on the other end of the, like, you know, rock spectrum. And, but just to finish, like, you know, connecting it to like, hey, what came before is great too. I mean, listen, I think all that like 68 to 78, or 81 Jamaican dub stuff like Studio One, Lee Scratch Perry, that gets the most play. That gets the most play in my days, like in the last couple of years. I just keep returning to it because there's something very, that the tempo and the instrumentation, like it is soothing and calming in a chaotic, at the end of a chaotic day, it's what I turn to. So that there's an energy there and an emotion there that I really value.
That's fantastic. The One Song Podcast is great for anyone, you know, whether or not you know exactly what each song is, it's still the deconstruction and the understanding and the appreciation and the love and the passion for music that you both have and the breadth of knowledge. It's just fun to watch people talk about things that they know about and care about. And I, again, push for, you know, I'm sure you get this all the time. People come up and they go, oh, you got to do this song. You got to do this one. Owner of a Lonely Heart, I would love to see it.
That's definitely, it's on the docket.
We encourage that. Okay, yeah.
Well, thank you guys. Owner for sure. It's good to see you. And Diallo, I hope to see you again this year soon for Halloween Horror Nights.
Let's go get scared.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
All right, this is the end.